Thanks for downloading our podcast. You can find out more about TechTent from our webpage. Go to bbcworldservice.com/techtent. Hello and welcome to TechTent, your weekly guide to what's hot and what's rot in the technology world. I'm Rory Catherine-Jones, and with me from the BBC Online Tech Desk is Jane Wakefield. Hello, Jane.
Hello, Rory.
Good to see you again. And my special guest today is Lucy Marcus, who's a board member at various companies, various tech companies, biotech companies, and she's also an expert on business ethics. Welcome, Lucy.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, and all the better for having you on the show. We'll be talking to Lucy about how Donald Trump's travel ban on citizens of certain countries will affect people and business. We'll also find out how mixed reality might be useful in the classroom and talk about a scheme to make tech investors of ordinary savers. Here's a quick taste of what's coming up.
We thought in Biscay, well, if we are actually asking our entrepreneurs and our SMEs to be innovative, maybe we as also as an institution, we should be entrepreneurs and innovative ourselves, right?
Oh, it's gone from flesh to the veins. I can see the skull.
All of that soon, but first, the mood in Silicon Valley has suddenly perked up. The week began with tech leaders worried about how to respond to President Trump's immigration policy. But by the end, they were turning their minds to more profitable matters, some spectacularly good results from Facebook and Apple, and the prospect of the biggest stock market debut by a tech firm for years. Now, that company was Snap, owner of Snapchat, a messaging app which is certainly not aimed at people of my age. So, Priscilla, we both got lunch. Is this snappable?
This is very snappable. And if you slide it, there's different filters.
Oh, plus to my story, OK. That's me getting a tutorial in Snapchattery from a young BBC colleague, Priscilla Ngethe. And we've got another young person on the line from Silicon Valley to discuss what Snap's IPO tells us about the mood there. Dave Lee, hello there.
Hello, Roy.
Now, I said young. I know you're just outside the Snapchat demographic, aren't you?
Well, actually, I'm considerably outside their main core user base. More than half of their users are aged between 13 and 24, which is quite remarkable when you think about it. So it's a very appealing app for advertisers, and I think that's what's going to take them through this IPO and make them all the more valuable.
And what did we learn from that chunky IPO document that landed last night about actual the nature of the business and how much money it's making?
Well, it's not making any money, is it? It lost over $500 million last year. That's up from the previous year. So that's a trajectory that they'll want to reverse fairly quickly. I think the thing that stood out for me most in that document in the IPO was when they outlined what they saw as the risks, because obviously they're obliged to do that legally, to say what they think is going to affect the business. And the main one they said, in a way, was they said increased competition in the US. And what they meant by that was Facebook, really, because Facebook has come along and repeatedly pinched the best ideas.
Careful about that word. Yeah, borrowed, well, imitated.
It's a rip-off. It really is. They look so identical. It's unbelievable. And on Instagram stories, Facebook Messenger, things that were on Snapchat have suddenly appeared on those apps and heavily borrowed, yes, is probably the more correct way to say
it. And what struck me was that a graph showing user growth, which seemed to flatten off recently, not the best position in which to be going into an IPO. Is it a Facebook, i.e. a company with massive growth ahead of it at stock market debut, or is it a Twitter, which basically ticks over and doesn't really grow much?
Well, every investor is going to be asking themselves that. I mean, I guess Snap's biggest strength at this point is that it's shown it can potentially diversify in a way that Twitter struggled. I mean, I've been using those spectacles. They're a piece of hardware. It's great fun. It shows they can make a good product that's sort of fairly highly priced, sells well, people are into it. I think that will give investors hope. You know, they're not entering this IPO in anywhere near as strong a position as Facebook were. And so at the moment, the comparison is probably closer to Twitter, which is probably a bad thing going forward.
Let's just have a quick word from our special guest, Lucy Marcus. You watch this world very closely. I know that you're not a Snapchatter, really, but
I'm distinctly outside their demographic. I can see that now.
And quickly, would you be bullish or bearish about its prospects as an investment?
Yeah, I mean, I'm always a bit skeptical on stuff like this. I was even with Facebook to a certain extent, and Twitter, though I'm an avid Twitter user, the same thing, you know, I think the opinion is correct that it could go either way. But since what it does is so easily acquired, and also people are fickle. We only like things for a certain amount of time and then we move on, particularly in this world. So.
Okay, and we've got to move on. Now, nice little corner turn there. Silicon Valley tech firms, as we've been hearing, have responded with concern to Donald Trump's ban on travel from seven predominantly Muslim countries. But those worries have been shared around the world. Here in the UK, I've been to visit a firm called World Remit, whose mobile payments technology helps migrants send money home. Its founder and chief executive, Ismail Ahmed, told me he had his own reasons to be worried when he heard about the travel ban.
It was a shock because I thought I would not be able to travel to the US. We have an office in Denver where we have just under 50 people. It is the largest remittance market. You know, we raise money from Silicon Valley investors.
Why did you think it might affect you? Why would you be targeted?
I've lived here since 1988. And I'm a British citizen, but I was born in Somaliland, which is an independent, peaceful country, but not recognized. So it's still considered to be part of Somalia. So because of that, Somalia was one of the countries that was banned.
And have you experienced any issues before when you traveled to the United States?
Yes. Every time I travel, often I face additional questions, or even when I send money, additional questions because I share both of my names with the former spiritual leader of the Palestinian group Hamas, Sheikh Ahmed Ismail, and my name is Ismail Ahmed. And so his name is on sanction lists. He died in 2004, but the American authorities decided to keep his name on the sanction list just in case. So often when I go to, when I travel, you know, the screening software will show that my name matches someone who is on a sanction list.
Have you tried out to find out, though, whether this does affect you? Because there was some reassurance from the British government after the weekend that this would not affect people like you.
Yes, I was definitely impacted by the order, affected by the ban, but I understand the UK government obtained an exemption. So there has been still a confusion, but it appears now that I may be able to travel, yes. But, I'll want to wait to see whether somebody does that first.
The impact on your wider company, your company is all about remittances. I presume that you're dealing with a lot of migrants, economic migrants, and refugees.
Yes, and you know there are 250 million people who live outside their home countries who then send an estimated $600 billion. And so, yes, a ban like this definitely affects some of our staff. You know, we have 330 people who work for us globally, representing around 35 nationalities. So this certainly affects both our staff and our customers. But ever since the Homo sapiens left East Africa some 50,000 years ago, we've been on the move. And migration is a fact of life. So Brexit or no Brexit, Trump or no Trump, we think people will continue to travel. And we live in an interconnected world where people are crossing borders frequently.
Don't you think, though, that over the last year there's been a definite swing back against the whole idea of migration?
It is a fact of life. We would have been extinct had we not been migrating, you know. We think, you know, and we see that happening still, you know, migration is still continuing.
Ismail Ahmed of World Remit. Now, the fallout from that immigration ban continues. Uber's boss, Travis Kalanick, resigned from the president's Economic Advisory Council this week after staff and customers made clear their anger. So our special guest, Lucy Marcus, who thinks about these sort of business ethic questions. Tech firms in Silicon Valley are walking a tightrope here, aren't they? Middle America seems actually quite enthusiastic about the ban. Their own staff aren't. How do you think they're handling things?
Well, I really loved what Ismail Ahmed said about migration being a fact of life, and his story is fascinating. And I think there are a number of things. One of the newest stories that's come out is that several of the large tech companies are trying to work for exclusions for their own employees of their own companies. And that makes me distinctly uncomfortable. This is a larger issue, and their consumers, you know, Facebook and Microsoft, their consumers are people from all over. And, between Brexit and this Muslim ban, and, you know, let's just call it what it is, and we're only in week two of the Trump administration, you know, companies and people don't like uncertainty and risk that comes from the kind of turmoil and the chaos that we're seeing right now.
Could this actually have an impact on investment into Silicon Valley as opposed to other places? Could Europe and the UK actually pick up some investment?
I really do believe that, because you've got places like Berlin and Paris and so on, that are in the EU, that are relaxed about movement to a certain extent, and the Scandinavian countries and so on. Academics and scientists, if they are feeling unwelcome and in limbo, then they're going to move. So I already know so many people who are looking for jobs outside of the UK, some of the greatest minds that we have, and they will go maybe to what seemingly right now is a less prestigious university, knowing that when they get there, it will become more prestigious. They'll have access to EU funding. And the same thing goes for the US.
OK, we'll be watching that very closely. I'm sure that's going to be a developing story. You're listening to Tech 10 on the BBC World Service with me, Rory Cathlin-Jones. In a moment, could augmented reality be the next big thing in the classroom? First, though, let's have a look at some of the week's other big tech stories with Jane Wakefield. Jane, we mentioned Facebook's very good results briefly, but not everything went their way this week.
No, it's not been an altogether rosy week for the social media network. It's facing damages of $500 million after it lost a legal challenge brought on its Oculus virtual reality technology. So the firm was called ZeniMax, and it claimed that its early innovations in virtual reality had been copied illegally by Facebook. The court agreed that Facebook was guilty of copyright infringements and a failure to comply with a non-disclosure agreement, but crucially it didn't find it guilty of the theft of trade secrets. But the incident will be embarrassing for Facebook, which of course had some very big plans for making virtual reality a social experiment on its platform.
It seems to be charging ahead with those plans and brushing off $500 million as if it was a bit of loose change. Given its results this week, I suppose not surprising. And I knew Amazon was trying out drone deliveries. What's this about having its own airport?
Yes. So Amazon continues to reach its tentacles far and wide. And this time it's announced it's going to build an air cargo hub at the Northern Kentucky Airport, near where it already has a big sort of centre for dealing with deliveries. Building this will cost close to $1.5 billion. And it's all part of Amazon's plan to ramp up its business, which currently it loses money on deliveries. But it is really encouraging everybody to sign up for its Prime service, which for a yearly subscription offers, among other things, next day delivery. So you can see that it wants to sort of be in control of its deliveries.
Maybe you get a free ride on an Amazon plane or train.
Yeah, holidays as
yeah.
well.
Apple's been under pressure to make the iPhone in America rather than China, notably from the new president. But it looks like it might be heading somewhere else.
Yeah, so it's long seen India as offering huge potential. And now officials in the southern Indian state of Karnataka have said that it plans to start building iPhones there. That hasn't been officially confirmed by Apple, although it has said that it's keen to invest significantly in India. And of course, it would make sense, because for it to be able to sell directly to customers in India, it has to source 30% of its products locally.
Lucy Marcus, companies have more than just economic decisions to make when they're talking about manufacturing these days. They usually just look for the cheapest place. There are other sort of political pressures, aren't there?
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I've written about this quite a bit, and about the responsibility of tech companies and manufacturers for their workers and also their extended supply chains. And, you know, it's interesting that one of the stories going around recently is that Mark Zuckerberg is doing a tour of the U.S. But really, I think instead he needs to do a tour of the world, where he actually, you know, they had trouble in India and so on. And they need to get out of the U.S. and start talking to people and understanding cultural differences and examining their supply chains and all of that.
Apple apparently looking to zero in on India rather than China, where its results not quite so sparkling last week. Now, if I said the words tech investor, you might picture someone with billions of dollars on hand to play with and a track record of picking global winners. But in Spain's autonomous Basque country region, which collects its own taxes, there's a plan to let ordinary savers invest in local startups. The idea is that people put up to 6,000 euros, that's about $6,500, in a special bank account and get a return in the form of a rebate on their income tax in the first year. I asked Asia Alia, the official who's created the scheme for the Basque province of Biscay, what he's trying to achieve.
The philosophy or the strategy behind this is that we think that in order to promote or to foster average citizens to invest in innovation, you have to create a safety scheme for them. So every single savings account will be channeled into a larger fund. And then social reciprocal guarantee firm will actually provide a guarantee in each of the investments, in each of the innovation projects that are funded by this.
So what you're doing is you're creating a fund which will back startup companies, and the people investing in that fund will be citizens who will get a tax rebate for doing so.
Yeah, it's actually quite innovative, and we thought in Biscay, well, if we are actually asking our entrepreneurs and our SMEs to be innovative, maybe we as an institution, we should be entrepreneurs and innovative ourselves, right?
So you're getting people effectively to invest in startups. Startups are incredibly risky. Most startups end up failing. What will happen to people's savings if a lot of these companies fail?
The reciprocal guarantee company will actually have to check how sound the project is. Still, these are going to be relatively large projects. Any project that actually goes from minimum of 100 or 200,000 all the way to 600,000. And we are actually already foreseeing that probably the average project that will come, innovation project, is around 400,000 euros. So the reciprocal guarantee company will decide which projects are financeable or not. Because after all, if any of those projects fails, it will be them, the ones that will have to put the money, since we are actually guaranteed with this. There is no risk whatsoever on the people's savings.
Asia Alia. Lucy Marcus, we're hearing all sorts of innovative ways now of getting money to tech startups. Does this sound a good idea, or does it sound like it's encouraging slightly risky behaviour, although people are guaranteed they won't lose their money?
Yeah, I mean, I love the idea because, you know, we talk a lot about global companies, but also the idea of investing in your own community and encouraging entrepreneurship in your own community is really nice. And you think about schemes that we have across the UK, like in Bristol and so on, where you have Bristol pounds or, you know, sort of special money that works locally. I love that. But actually, the one question and really where the success or failure comes in is actually on the other end that they didn't discuss at all, which is who's running the fund, how good are the companies, and what kind of terms are they offering the companies? Are they going to take a stake? Are they going to give a loan?
And the other question is how good governments, local or otherwise, are at doing this kind of stuff,
exactly.
whether they should leave it to the professionals.
Well, and I mean, they can recruit a professional to come in, but also it's not just about investing money, but it's also creating an ecosystem. So if they're incubating them, you know, what sort of things will they be giving them in additional services? And also if they're isolated in that particular, I mean, I'm not very familiar with Biscay, but if they're isolated, if there's no university or there's no one to draw from for all of the technology or other skills that they need, then they're going to have to build an entire ecosystem. But I like the initiative, and I love the idea of people feeling a sense of ownership over, you know, the helping to build that ecosystem. I just think that if it fails, then everyone's going to say, oh, this doesn't work.
Yeah, I'm sure there are some people waiting to see that fail, but good luck to it. Now, augmented reality, sometimes called mixed reality, is one of the hottest tech trends of the moment. The idea is that digital information can be superimposed on the real world. And Jane Wakefield, you've been finding out how this might catch on in the classroom.
Yes, at the BET Educational Technology event in London, I got a demo of how the HoloLens technology might be used in teaching.
I'm looking at a 3D model of a human body. Oh, it's gone from flesh to the veins. I can see the skull right in front of me as if it was there.
Tap the body to view each system.
And it is extremely realistic and a little bit scary.
Using holograms, we can easily separate and focus in on individual systems. For example, we can focus in on the femur, a bone in the leg.
So that's an example of what it does in that case, looking at the human body.
It's a sort of headset that you're wearing.
Yeah, so you wear the headset and in front of you is a 3D body, human body, which then sort of peels apart. You can use your arms to sort of gesture for certain bits of it to move. I mean, you can see it's going to be amazing in certain circumstances. And I asked Roger Walkden from Microsoft why he thinks schools will go for tools like HoloLens.
People really love the idea of learning in 3D. I think visualization of data is so much more interesting and a much more collaborative way to be able to work in a school environment. My favorite example is the idea of being able to understand volume. So when you tell a kid what to try and understand the volume of a square, it's really, really difficult for them to understand that. But if you can actually show them a square and show them that that is a meter wide and that is how much a meter is, and then show them how you can build volume inside a 3D environment, suddenly they get it. And that's the kind of thing that you get with a HoloLens, visualization of 3D things, which are previously just been on paper.
As Roger Walkden of Microsoft. Now, Jane, we've heard lots of techie ideas coming into classrooms, interactive whiteboards, yeah. Every child getting a tablet. This is just the latest fad, isn't it? Is this really going to catch on?
Well, I think one of the big barriers to it is the cost. So a HoloLens device at the moment costs around $3,400. So, I mean, there's not many schools that are going to be able to afford that. But virtual reality and augmented reality, you can see as being not just a sort of device, but actually really helping the curriculum and teaching the curriculum in new ways. I mean, we've seen textbooks and paper for so long now, you know.
We've seen predictions of textbook and paper disappearing forever. Mm. We've seen these electronic whiteboards that quite often sit, you know, gathering dust.
I think people do use those now, but again, it's just a tool, isn't it, rather than changing the curriculum.
Lucy Malkus, quick take from you on this. Are you keen on this kind of technology coming into schools?
I am, actually. I mean, one of the things that we've learned over time is that kids learn in different ways. And though I agree that it could be very expensive for schools, I also tried this a year or so ago when I was in Davos. They had a setup and you could go through the solar system and it was truly amazing. And I think the other thing it can maybe help with over time is online education and distance learning and so on. I mean, a square, well, you can hold a cube, but there are other things that you can only experience virtually. And I think from that perspective, it could be wonderful, especially, you know, for kids that might have learning disabilities and so on. I like the idea.
Yeah, it's a very exciting technology. Let's see whether it's hyped or really actually going to end up in classrooms. We've run out of time again. Thanks to my special guest, Lucy Malkus, tech and corporate governance consultant. Thanks to Jane Wakefield from the BBC Tech Desk. Read all of our stories at bbc.com/technology. And don't forget to join us in the Tech Tent at the same time next week.